Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Quokka, spelt Quokka, pronounced Quokka. 100 degree boiling hot water from your tap. Today is another special. Today's conversation is with Dr. Giles Yeo, who's written a book, Gene Eating, The Science of Obesity and the Truth Behind Diets. Basically, we discuss everything from why we want to store fat, to why people are eating too much, what we're eating, all the diets. It's all there, and with humor as well. That's the good thing about Dr. Giles Yeo. He's humorous as well. Let's listen to him.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Giles, welcome to my kitchen. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
As always, I've bought you a present. I buy all my guests a present. And I've just been to Brussels. And so I bought back this. There was a shop and everyone seemed to be buying this. It's the spreads. They had many different types of it, but the woman said this is the special one. It's called Speculoos spread. And that right. Speculoos is a type of biscuit that they have over there. Right. I thought I'd buy this for you because it is just ram-packed full of badness.
Oh, what is it? Let's have a look.
It's got all sorts of shit. It's got no palm oil in it.
No palm oil in it. But what's actually, what is speculoos?
It's a type of biscuit that they eat a lot in Belgium.
But it's got rapeseed oil. It's got, I can't actually read this, candy syrup. I don't even know what candy syrup concentrate. Yeah. Like the evil of the world. Some people think it's the evil of the world. Whatever candy syrup concentrate is.
Well, I thought it'd be good.
Butter in capital letters.
Butter, yeah.
Thank you.
So I thought it was just fitting that it was probably really bad for you, so I thought I'd buy you that as we're about to discuss diet. After reading your book, I seem to think that you do eat bad stuff, though, don't you?
Well, what does bad mean? I mean, that's always a thing, right? And so it's interesting that because of the book, because of what I do for telly as well, people think I'm judging them when they eat. You know, if someone recognizes me at a buffet, you know, you might catch me and go, are you looking at what I'm eating? No, I'm not looking at what you're eating because I don't judge people. And I think bad is a very interesting thing. What is bad? I think if you eat too many carrots, it's a bad thing. So I think bad is a dose issue.
Can you just move your pop shield down just a tiny, this bit down just a tiny bit? That's it, so we can make sure we see your face. All right, first of all, Giles, what do you do in your day job? What is it you're actually doing?
So I'm a trained geneticist, and in my day job, I research how our brain controls food intake at the University of Cambridge. And I also teach medical students and the vets their biochemistry.
Okay. How good are we in the world at knowing this stuff in Britain?
Knowing which stuff? Knowing biochemistry?
Yeah, well, the sort of stuff that you're learning about, how cutting edge are we about diet and things like that?
I see. Okay. I think it depends on which level you're talking about. In genetics, I think we're probably one of the world leaders, just broadly speaking, actually because of the NHS, and because in NHS people trust doctors and they're willing to volunteer. Okay. Right. So in genetics, we're very good. In terms of in diets and food intake, I think we're as good and as bad as everyone else. You know, we're in a judgmental sense where we think we know a lot, but we probably don't.
Right. But in that's the thing when after reading your book. I love your book, by the way. I really thoroughly enjoyed it. And it's answered quite a lot of questions for me, which we'll get stuck into about diet. But it's nice that in Britain we are leading the way in a lot of things.
Because
we beat ourselves up a lot over here, but I think a lot of the world looks at us in certain things and says we're forging the way a lot, aren't we?
No, it's true. I mean, people use the term punching above our weight, but it's true. We don't make a lot of things anymore. This is also true, but we make minds. MINDS, not minds. Minds, and we make minds. We are a world leader when it comes to actually research, and cutting edge research. We are a world leader, and we got to be proud about that, and we have to really sell it.
So why do you think food being one of the most important things we're going to do in our lives every day, i.e. most days, why is it that we know so little about it?
Because I think there's a historical reason in which the problem we have with food, I'm using this in its broader sense, diet-related illnesses that we actually see today has snuck up on us, sort of. Suddenly it was, you watched the 70s, it wasn't a problem. Suddenly it became a problem. So that's the first thing. I think we weren't concentrating on it and suddenly it became a problem.
Right.
And when it suddenly became a problem, because it happened relatively quickly, people must have thought, well, it's a behavior thing. It's the fault of the people. So why study it? People just need to go back to what they were before the '70s, and we'll actually fix the problem. So I think it's a combination of two: the fact that there's a historical thing where it wasn't a problem, then suddenly became a problem, and then people then begin to think that, well, it's just a behavioral issue. So why are we bothering actually studying you studying it? And as a result, we're suddenly in a situation where people, where we need to do better. We need to understand our food environment better, and we need to do it without doing a number of things: judging the people that are eating the food environment, and actually demonizing the people who are making the food. A lot of people say big food, you know, in really kind of Bond villain-esque bad words, you know, big food. There's big pharma, there's big pig, you know. Yeah. But big food is this bad thing. Why is this bad thing? I mean, what are food companies trying to do? Are they trying to make a buck? Yeah, of course they are, because they're companies. Are they actually out there to make us fatter and iller? No, because otherwise we'd die and not buy their food. They're trying to make money. They're trying to make us eat more. And this is all true. So how do we make our food environment better? I think we need to study, understand more about how we interact with food. But also, we need to tell the companies making our food how to make the food better. And so people that demonize the companies, I don't think are helping the situation.
I did a good podcast the other day on death, and with Dr. Catherine Mannix, and she points out, which is really interesting, that we just used to die and accept it, and then in the halfway through the last century, we suddenly started going, you don't have to die, we can heal you from cancer and heart disease and things like this. So we've become more afraid of death because we now think there's a solution to it all. So you could be 98 years old or something. You go to the hospital and the relatives are going, how can you cure them?
How can this 98-year-old person die?
Yeah. And I suppose that's what's happened with food, because we've now got more food than ever.
Yeah.
And so it's another thing we can start looking at. The point you point out is that probably my grandparents didn't have an abundance of food. Their parents before them definitely didn't. But my parents suddenly had enough food to eat all the time after the war. And now, my generation, we've got anything we want all the time. Constant calories. We never have to worry about food.
You can do it from your couch. You can do it from your couch, yeah, and your phone. You don't even have to go to the supermarket anymore to get your food.
And there's very few people, I suppose, who, you know, I mean, there's poverty in this country and there's poverty in the world, but there's very few people, I suppose, in the great scheme of things as a percentage, who can't eat whenever they want to eat.
That's right. But do you know what irony is not the word I would choose to use. The big tragedy of it is that actually there are two interesting things. The first is that we have reached the first time in the entire history of humankind, probably a couple of years ago, where there are more people dying of over-nutrition, too many calories, than there are dying of too few calories. So just think about that, the inequality in the world. But interestingly, the people who are dying of over-nutrition are also being malnourished. Okay, so in other words, they're getting enough calories but are still getting a poor diet. How can you have too many calories but still be dying because of a poor diet, because of not actually eating well enough? So at both extremes, we have the same problem: is malnourishment, but in two diametrically opposite ways. One too skinny and not enough food. Yeah. One too much food and too much of the wrong type of food.
And is it true 60% of us are overweight in the Western world?
Yes. I mean, if we use the BMI, which is imperfect, but if we use purely BMI above a BMI of 25, then yes, 60% of us are above a BMI of 25. So I just recently, because of my vegan diet and what have you, just dipped ever so slightly to 24.9 BMI. But for much of my life, I was at BMI 26, BMI 27. So I was overweight for a long time.
So you're a vegan now?
No. I was on a vegan diet briefly for a month for a tele program. I am now flexitarian. That sounds like a cop out. I know. Do you see you laughing, mate? Yeah. So partially yes. vegan, which actually makes vegans hate me more. But there right. we go.
That's I like to think of myself as a superhero because I seem to be able to eat everything. And I don't like coriander, and I don't like, what else don't I like? I don't really like truffle oil, and I don't like goat's cheese, but I'm able to eat everything without having any problems. So I'm a superhero.
You're a superhero. Without a cape, but fantastic superhero.
In the food world. All right, so we've now got an abundance of food. That's what's happened. We've got too much food. But you explain it well. Why is it that we now are continuing to eat? Why don't we go, I'm full up, I've eaten enough. Why do we keep eating?
So it comes down to what we're evolved to do. Because we never had enough food, bar probably 30 or 40 years ago, okay, never had enough. Or because we never could eat as much as we wanted all the time, we evolved to make sure that when there was food available to actually eat. Okay, so this is what's kept us alive till today. Except obviously, we're now in this... no longer in a feast-famine environment. We're in a feast-feast environment. And so this is part of the problem. So we eat whenever food is available. So we're evolved to eat when there is food, not to stop eating. That's what we're evolved to do.
And we want to get fat because we want to have fat. Well, we want to store
fat. We want to store fat.
Yeah.
The problem is when there is no famine in between the feasts and we eat as much as we want, then we get carry too much fat. But the goal was never to carry too much fat because we never had enough food to trigger that.
Right.
We always were just on the edge of starvation almost. And so we just needed to make sure we pack some on in order to stay alive during those lean times.
So is a healthy person a fat person?
So is the healthy person a fat person today? And I think no, okay. But I think a highly evolved person... in today. So in other words, what has kept us alive is our drive to eat. It's one of these things where you see these stick insects wandering around today. How did you survive in the Serengeti? You know, how did you not get, and that's it. So I think carrying too much fat is not a good thing for any number of different reasons, but it is definitely the natural response to the food environment we're living in now.
All right. But your body wants to have fat just in case.
Yes.
Okay, so and in women more so than men,
for different reasons. Okay, so both of us, men and women, need fat. Women need enough fat to be able to reproduce, to be able to get pregnant, and thus keep the baby alive. And then when the baby comes out, enough fat to be able to produce milk. All of those things. So women do carry fat in different areas, and there is a different drive for why women are going to need to carry the fat. But it is still all about survival.
Yeah. So I interviewed Tim Spector, and he said, a calorie? This is a conversation about microbes in your stomach." And he said, "A calorie does not necessarily equal a calorie." I think it was him who told me this, because he said that when you become a teenager, women start wanting to put fat on because they're getting ready to. Procreate, whatever, begin pregnancy. They need the fat, as you've just said. Whereas men start getting leaner. So what we do with the calorie in the body is different.
What we do in the calorie is different. Not the huge difference between men and women, but even between you and me, it will be different. You're absolutely right. In fact, I think men are very simple creatures. Really, we think we think about food and we think about the other thing. But that's pretty much us till the day we die. Women, I want to argue, are four different species throughout their lives, depending on their so. There's women pre baby.
Yeah.
There's women during pregnancy for those who get pregnant. They're entirely different species when they're pregnant because they're carrying a parasite in them. I have a child, so there we go. Women post pregnancy. Because some women keep the weight. Some women are like rubber bands. They suddenly lose all the weight. Why? Yeah. Okay. And women post-menopause. Entirely different in terms of their shape. Okay. Maybe sometimes even their behavior. Okay. Depending on what the hormones are and your genetic background. But definitely their shape. Definitely their size and where they store their fat.
So why do some women just ping back then and some don't?
The answer is we don't know. And that's it's clearly going to have something to do with your individual biology, but the actual genes involved, we don't know. And there are people that I know who are very interested in studying this because we know women who then in effect gain more and more weight as they have more kids, because they don't lose the weight.
It seems so bizarre that governments don't spend more money on studying food and diet and what's happening.
I think food and diets, governments probably have been studying in terms of, you know, vitamins and in terms of fiber, and people are actually trying to study that. But in terms of overnutrition, in terms of trying to solve the fact that we have too much of it, governments are not spending enough money. I need to be careful. I do work for a government-funded obesity unit. Right. Just want to say the MRC Metabolic Diseases Unit. But I think we could be spending a lot more.
Why do cats and things, animals, don't? I mean, you mentioned your book, Labradors, they overeat. Mm-hmm. But a lot of animals don't if you stick enough food in front of them. Why is it humans are so proposed?
Oh, no, people? I don't think it's going to be specific to humans. It's right. Just that regular, if you look at obesity in pets. If you look at obesity in pets, they mirror the obesity in human beings. You know that first scene in 101 Dalmatians, in you know, where they look like, you end up looking like your dog. In many ways, that probably is true, because what happens is you feed your pets the way, sometimes the way you feel. Feed, I don't yourself. Think there's any scientific basis for this, but undoubtedly pet obesity is actually rising. Okay, the issue is that most animals still don't get too much. Too much food don't get too much food.
Right, okay. So what is it that's going on in our brains then that's making us desperate to eat food?
So your brain does all the command control, unsurprisingly, including command and control of our food intake and our behavior around food. And your brain needs to know two pieces of information, broadly. It needs to know how much fat you have, because how much fat you have is how long you last in the wild without any food. So it's a pretty important piece of information. So if you stop food today, how long will you live? That's down to how much fat you carry.
Yeah.
And the second is what you are currently eating and what you have just eaten. So your short-term signals, and those signals come from your gut, okay? At your stomach and gut. So your brain then integrates those two signals, how much long-term stores I have and what you've just eaten, and then interprets this, integrates it, and then influences your next interaction with food. And in terms of why it actually makes you eat more, because your brain considers any weight loss at all as a big red flag that you are reducing your chances of survival. And so if you lose some weight, it'll think, oh, why am I losing weight? It'll actually drive you to try and put that weight back on. And for some people, this weight might be a couple of pounds. For some people, maybe it triggers after a kilo or after 10 pounds, you know, whatever it is.
So say my body's 75 kilos. That's kind of the weight I like to be at, 75 kilos. If I lose down to 73, 74, yep. It will try and get me back up to 75 as quickly as possible.
Yes.
What has set me at 75? What has decided, let's just take that figure. I'm probably a bit more than that. But what has set me at 75? Who's decided that? My parents, the genes, what's decided that I should be at 75?
I think a large part of it is going to be down to your genes. This is the so-called set point hypothesis, although this is slightly simplistic. It's probably a set range, so it's not a single point. But all of us have a body weight in which we can stay at relatively easily without gaining or losing weight. Now, most of us wish we could lose a few pounds. Yeah. And it's when we lose those few pounds and suddenly look at yourself, ooh, I look good today. But then suddenly you gain back that weight. And then you're sitting there at a slobby, whatever it is, I'm 75 kilos, you know, thinking, oh, I wish I could be 70 kilos. But I don't gain any weight above 75 kilos, right? But I just wish I was lighter. And so it's going to have a huge, huge genetic input about why you are trying to protect 75.
Okay, so if I go into the gym and start, like, I start eating protein shakes or drinking protein shakes, eating, you know, a couple of steaks a day, tins of tuna, I'm pumping iron, and I get myself up to 85 kilos, mm-hmm. and then I stop, mm-hmm. will my body quickly try and get me back down to 75 kilos?
Muscles are a very, very different thing, I think, because in terms of from a fat perspective, okay, mm-hmm. okay, so there's a caveat here. Like the caveat is your body is primarily designed to stop you from losing weight, not necessarily from gaining weight. So there's evidence, it's difficult to obtain, that your set points can go up, meaning that if you stay, if you get too heavy for too long from fat rather than from muscle, two different things, that sometimes your set point can actually go up, meaning you start defending a higher weight a higher weight.
Okay.
Okay, so this is, yeah. And it's sort of like a vicious cycle. But definitely from the going down perspective, it'll drag you back up. But that saying, if you gain weight relatively temporarily, so in other words, post-Christmas, for example, or post-holiday season, you will tend to go back down to your to close to where you were before.
How does a cheat day work? You know, all these people on diets, and they're doing their whatever they're doing. Let's take the paleo diet or something.
Yeah.
Let's not get into that. We'll get into that in detail later.
Yeah.
But then they go, this is my cheat day, and I can eat whatever I like.
Yeah.
That's the rules. I can eat, like, I look at Dwayne, what's his name?
The Rock Johnson. The Rock,
yeah. And the stuff he eats on his cheat day is it's obscene how much food and how many calories he's eating. But he says that's fine to do. On your cheat day, you can eat whatever you want. Is that reality or not?
I think the reality, that is a strategy. And that works for some people where you are really, really restrictive. However, whatever the restriction you're doing, yeah. For most days. And then for one day you decide that, hang it, I'm just going to eat whatever I want. That is a strategy. Another strategy might be to say that, well, I'm going to eat what I want, but less of it every day. That can be more difficult for some other people. And for some people, maybe they don't eat on two days and then eat whatever they want after.
But the day you eat six pizzas, why doesn't the body just go, I'm turning all those six pizzas into fat? Does it have a ability to go, I only need one of these and the rest I'll just get rid of?
No, it doesn't get rid of it. It will convert it to fat. So whatever you eat that is spare is converted into fat. So sugar, you can only keep sugar as glycogen. You can maybe carry about 2,000 calories of glycogen in you. So when you carbo load, for example, before a long run, you can maybe only keep up to 2,000 calories of that. And glycogen are chains of glucose. Protein, you cannot.
What happens to the rest of it then if you're eating more? It gets rid of it.
Nope.
Turns it into fat.
Yes. And protein, what happens is, yes, if you're pumping iron and drinking protein shakes, then it's converted to protein. Whatever's left over, fat. And fat is fat. So everything that is spare, is you don't poop it out. If you don't burn it, it's stored as fat.
So if I eat six Mars bars,
yep,
that's going to turn into fat.
Well, it depends, right? Because if you eat six Mars bars today and tomorrow you continue eating six Mars bars, don't eat six Mars bars, depends what you do the next day. But yes, it is. So correct.
So it'll go into glycogen. Okay, well, so what's the stuff coming out of me then? What is my feces? What's the waste product?
Okay, so 50% of the weight of your poop is bacteria from your gut. 50%. Okay, then you're gonna have the fiber, which you can't actually digest at all. And there's stuff that's stuck within the fiber. It's the stuff that you cannot digest. But it's not going to be, there's going to be some fat in there, but that's not because you are turning, it's not because you're melting fat away and then it's going into your waste. It's a one-way system, right? So you eat and the stuff goes from here and out the other side. If it gets absorbed in your body, then in order for you to get rid of it, you got to burn it. It doesn't, you don't wee it out, you don't poo it out. You have to burn it once it's in fat.
All right. So what is making me, what's this leptin thing?
So leptin.
Leptin,
yeah,
sorry.
So leptin is one of the signals, probably the most important one, which informs your brain how much fat you have. So leptin is a fat hormone, and the more fat you have, the more leptin you have. And it circulates in the blood. It's a fat hormone. And your brain senses this as one of the signals to let you know how much fat you actually have. And so in order to influence your food intake, that's the first role. But the second role is when leptin levels dip too low, it means that you have too little fat. You don't have enough fat. And when it dips below a certain amount, meaning that you're starving, because that's what happens, it turns on the starvation response. And the starvation response is to eat, freaking hell, just eat. And second, to save energy for your brain, triage, because your brain does a command control, so that you can still put together a strategy to actually look for food. So that's what leptin does. It signals how much fat you have, and it signals when you have too little fat to turn on starvation.
So you're pointing this out in your book, that the major thing of the body is to look after the brain first.
That's right.
So in females, it's a good example. If you're starving, or maybe if you do something like endurance and you're not getting enough calories because of you're doing a huge endurance, it switches off the reproductive system.
That's right, because reproduction, the reproductive system, particularly in women, is very expensive. Ladies, at that time of the month, you know, it might sound ha-ha, but it isn't, because if you're at the edge of starvation, all that wasted calories at that time of the month is the difference between life and death. So your brain, if you're starving, your brain shuts that bit off. Secondly, if you're actually starving, how are you going to plop a baby out into the Serengeti and keep the baby alive? There won't be enough fat for you to make milk. So what your brain doesn't take chances with human, you know, feelings and emotions and blah. So what it does is your brain just shuts it off. So there's no chance.
What is hungry? What is being hungry?
I think it does depend on how you actually determine it. I think hungry to you and to me and most people is that grumbly feeling in your stomach and that you're actually feeling of driving towards actually food, okay? Yeah. Appetitive behavior. But you might also argue that anything which attracts you more to food and make you eat it could make you feel hungry, and that is then more complicated. So I think that's a simple thing of saying that I am in calorie deficit because I've burnt X number of calories and I'm hungry now and I want to eat. That's the traditional view of hunger. But you could hunger for food without being in calorie deficit as well.
Yeah, but what is happening though that makes me, that drives me towards wanting to eat? What is actually hungry? What's going on in my body that goes, I now need to eat?
Okay, so it's a mix of the two. So the hunger, unless you're starving, doesn't typically come from fat. Okay, so what the fat is there to do is long term. It doesn't tend to change overnight. It doesn't your fat levels. So the signals from fat don't tend to signal hunger, except for when you're starving. Then there's a whole different ball game that appears. The signals from hunger and fullness tend to come from your gut because that is real time. It senses real time what's going on. And so there are hormones in the, one particular hormone, for example, which actually trigger a hunger sensation to actually want to make you eat. It kind of spikes, it's called ghrelin. It kind of spikes before meals. Okay, and that's one of the drivers of hunger. Saying they did an experiment, okay, where they put people in a Las Vegas-like scenario, meaning that in a dark room with lights, but with no time cues. Okay, and there was a big red button, but they could then say when did they want their food, and people pressed the button at roughly at different times, but there was a surge of this particular hormone before they pressed the button. Oh, I'm a bit peckish now, and that was the, that was the drive.
So it sent, this hormone sends a signal to your brain, which then starts going, I need to look for food.
Yep.
Okay, so that one and leptin.
Yep.
They're both going, we need to eat now. Tim, we need to go out there and we need to get ourselves...
Leptin only when it falls below a certain amount. When it's there in enough amounts, all it's doing is letting your brain know how much fat you have. Imagine a fuel gauge where the emergency light doesn't come on your fuel gauge until it drops below a certain amount.
Yeah, so which one's the one which is making us obese? Which is the one that's making us to overeat? Or is it a combination of both of them?
It's going to be a combination of both of them. Okay. It's because your brain senses the two pieces of information. Your brain never sees each signal independently. Okay. It always is a ratio between all the various signals.
When you're tired, you start craving calories, don't you?
Some people do. Not everybody does. And so that's a very different... So that comes down to when you're... to how you respond to certain insults, I'm going to call. Not I'm insulting you. Yeah, environmental insults. Stress, for example. Mm-hmm. So some people respond to stress by eating. This could be tired. Yeah. Okay. Some people respond to stress by not eating. Okay. It's exactly the same hormone, cortisol. But yet people just respond in completely diametric opposites. I respond by eating. And I have specific comfort foods.
So our desire to eat, and so when we look at, because we look at people who are overweight, especially obese people, with disdain, don't we, in society?
We do.
And the health industry does as well. Yep. And the governments do. Everyone does. And I've spoken to you about this. You're not sure that's right. But it's just a desire. Our food has changed dramatically, hasn't it? Very sugary and carbohydrate led. And also we have this desire, which is a new desire now. It's an old desire. In a new thing. There's a very good way. I love the bit in your book where you discuss about bears eating fish. So bears, when they want to get ready for the winter, stuff as many salmon in them as possible. And towards the end, that little bit where we have enough room for dessert, you point out.
The bears only eat the skin. And this is true. And we know that this effect. And if you then consider that, because bears don't have dessert per se at the end of a meal, whereas we do. And desserts tend to be, you're not going to have, there's no celery dessert. Dessert tends to be high in sugar and fat. And we, so our dessert tummy is the same tummy that the bear has. We're eating the skin rather than the whole salmon.
Because everyone says there's always room for dessert and there's always room for a piece of chocolate.
And it's true. And there's a biologically driven reason for it. It's true. It's to stuff as many calories in as possible, even when we're already stuffed.
Right. So you think we should be looking more sympathy than disdain towards people who have eating disorders or who are overeating?
Oh, undoubtedly. Now, eating disorders is a different thing. Okay. It's a different thing. But I think for people who are, people have a tendency to think of obesity and non-obese as a binary decision and a binary choice. We have a biological basis to our body weight. It's just that some people's body weight are going to be set obese and some non-obese and some average in the current environment. And so obesity is not a choice. It's not a choice. People don't choose to be obese. If you actually interview and ask people who are, would you like to lose weight? Okay, some people maybe want to gain weight, but the vast majority of people will say, I'd like to lose weight. Then you might say, well, why don't you? And they'll say, because it's difficult. Because they may say, because I'm greedy. They may say, because I find it hard. They may use any number of terms that are actually, some might even say, because people have told it to them, because they're lazy, because they're bad, because they're weak. No, because your biology is setting you up to eat and get to a certain size within the current environment we're living in. I think we have to look at the biology, but we also have to tackle the environment.
Okay, we'll get on to some diets in a minute then to describe this. But interesting in reading your book about leptin. There are people who are born without any leptin. That means they just put on huge sums of...
They put on huge sums of weight because of a lack of the signal informing their brains. So this is very rare, by the way. In the world, it was discovered in 1997 by actually my current boss, Professor Stephen O'Ratley, our head of department. But in effect, because they lack the signal to let their brain know how much fat they have, their brain thinks they have no fat. This is pretty much it. And so they are constantly starving. So aside from the fact, so just to give you an idea of scale. So I talk about in the book that there is a three-year-old, initially when he was identified, who's 42 kilograms. Mm. So we talked about the fact that we're times 2.2 for pounds divided by 14 for stone. But you say that you're 75, I'm also 75 kilos. That's a three-year-old who's two-thirds our body weight. This is not fizzy drink obesity. This child has a brain which thinks it's starving even though he has a huge amount of fat on him. Mm. And so he keeps eating because it's trying to... Imagine if you're actually starving. Like we're seldom. In fact, I don't think I've ever been starving before. But you're really, really hungry. You think, oh my God, I'm going to eat anything you want. Even broccoli tastes great, right? When you're really, really, really hungry. But if you're actually starving, imagine what that feels like. And there's no way to satiate and to actually make yourself feel full. Terrible.
Should we be getting hungry? I listened to a few podcasts and read a few books where people say part of being an mammal, is to get hungry. It's part of the thing we should be doing. Should we be getting more hungry, do you think?
So that is a very interesting question, meaning... All right, I'm going to turn it around in another way, all right?
Okay.
Where there are studies on many animal models out there, worms, flies, and even mice, which shows that if you actually restrict their calories, say to two-thirds that what they would freely eat, what happens in almost every creature that has been studied, it extends their lifespan. And you're thinking, wow, that is fantastic. I can actually live longer if I eat less. Until you go through the process of actually eating two-thirds of what you actually want to eat. So I think you'll live longer but feel miserable. So I think... I just get the feeling that we have to be... Which is true, okay? Yeah. I think... And that's fine. That may have been true in caveman times, but you would have been eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. So let's ignore that. But I think it's going to be a balance. I do think it's going to be a balance. I think... But being hungry is just unpleasant. Isn't it?
Well, I don't know, because I do the because I know a meal's coming, It's something I can get through.
That's very different.
Because I do the intermittent fasting. Yeah, I do that quite often. So I'll only eat for 8 hours a day. When I get towards my 8 hours, I think, well, I know I'm about to eat, so I don't mind being hungry.
That's very different. So in your head, you know from your motivation perspective that there's going to be food coming. And then when you then... But how do you make sure... I mean, I'm looking at your body habitus, and maybe you don't have a problem with this, but how do you make sure you then don't overindulge when the food is actually there? I mean, that's always... I just come off the intermittent fasting as well. For a month, once again, for another program, doing, hated it. Hated every minute of it, because what happened? it's interesting.
What were you doing? Were you doing daily ones?
Or 5-2. I was doing the so-called 5-2.
I couldn't do the 5-2. That day where you're hungry.
Starving, hungry. And so I hated it. And not only that, then I overindulged, even though I tried not to, on the immediate day after I stopped fasting.
Right.
And then I dreaded the day that I was going to be fasting. So for me, you're talking about the hunger, I hated that day of hunger so much. I can't imagine my whole life like that. I'm just not worth living.
Someone told me though, after 40 minutes after eating, your hunger passes. Is this true? Is it 14 minutes? Is there any figure on that, or is it just nonsense?
No. It's this. Okay, I don't know if it's exactly 14 minutes, right. But the key thing is letting the food get into the stomach and then into the small intestine, because then that begins the process of releasing hormones. So while I talk to you about the fact that there is a hormone from the gut which makes us feel hungry, almost all of the hormones released from your gut make you feel full. Okay, because what happens is when you actually eat, and if you stop for a bit, okay, leaving time for the food to actually get into the stomach and into small intestine, it will begin to release hormones that naturally make you feel fuller. That is true.
Okay.
That's how the whole process of saying eat slower, chew 100 times. The chewing 100 times is not because you are doing anything with the food. It's to force you to eat slower, to give time for your gut hormones to say, oh, there's food, and to signal and to make you feel full, so you end up eating less.
And I suppose that good expression, a moment on the lips, a lifetime on the hips, is kind of an interesting thing, because you get that taste sensation, which is generally sugar or vinegar or something like that, or salt, and you get that amazing feeling. But
for some people, it's fat.
Fat?
For some people, it's fat.
Is it?
Mm.
By the time it's hit down into your stomach, it doesn't matter what on earth went on in the mouth, does it? It's what's going on in your...
It's what's going on in there. Now, what the food is made of definitely influences what goes on in there. But you're right. What it's sensing is not lovely vinegar, lovely anything.
Yeah.
What it's sensing in there is how much fat, carbs, and protein, and that influences the gut hormones that are released. Right.
So I used to say on Sunday brunch all the time, I'm pointing this, so unless you're watching the video, you'll have to understand I'm pointing at my stomach first. And I used to say, don't worry, I used to point at my mouth first, don't worry about what's going on in here. And I point at my belly, worry about what's going on in here. Because that when you eat, you should be eating with your stomach and what your body wants rather than your mouth. But that's too hard to do, because if you stick the worst thing in the world is a buffet. Oh my God, buffets. Have you done any science on buffets? Because as soon as you get a buffet, you must eat five times more food than you've ever eaten.
No, it's true. It's true. Because we're going back into a situation where you look at the buffet, suddenly some caveman, primeval kind of primordial drive to actually eat comes on. Definitely.
Right. So just going back a bit, sorry, to leptin. I'm talking all over the place here. That's all right. But it's fascinating stuff. With that young boy you were talking about, eventually people inject him with leptin, and it worked.
Yes.
It suppressed his hunger.
Yes.
So surely now, I know you're going to say no because I've read the book, but surely if you inject me every day with leptin, I will never be hungry, and so I can lose all my weight.
So and you're right. Because this child was first described in 97, this treatment in which was published, once again by my colleagues in Cambridge, this wasn't work done by me, was published in 2000. We're now in 2019, and no one has heard of this magic drug because it doesn't actually exist. So it comes down to what the biological role of leptin is, okay? When there is enough leptin, I think let's go back to the fuel gauge in the car.
Yeah.
Okay, where as long as you have above the red light, most people don't care. I mean, I'm a bit of obsessive, and I don't like my car going below a quarter. But as long as there's enough fuel, okay, and it can get you home, then the car will get you home. You'll start the next day.
Yeah.
Whereas if you get down to the red light eventually it may run out of fuel, okay? So if you, by adding more fuel, it doesn't make the car, it doesn't change anything. So it's only when you have too little, you need to get it up past the red line. So adding more leptin is not going to change your feeling behavior if you already have enough leptin.
They did. They found all this out with these sort of strange things as well by sewing mice together. A lot of the stuff in your book was experiments. Whoever sews mice together constantly, are they going to go to heaven? Jesus Christ!
So by the way, this is old experiments. It can't be done. It was a different time, I didn't actually do that. But yeah, exactly. It was a different time. It's a reverse Siamese twin kind of like surgery. You're right.
All right. I want to cover some of the diets now, if that's okay with
you. That's okay.
I was just going to point this out. There is so much information in your book. It's such a great read because you basically cover everything I've ever thought on diet. So I'm not going to do it justice now, probably on the podcast, but it's well worth buying this book to read it if you're interested in diet. Let's start with a calorie. What is a calorie?
Okay, so from a physics perspective, a calorie is the amount of energy it takes to raise 1 liter of water 1 degree Celsius at sea level. I know it's very dry. Okay, so it's a fixed unit of energy. That's what a calorie is. And so when you read the back of a pack of calories, they calculate calories by bomb calorimetry. And what they do literally is you put it into a sealed container wrapped in a water jacket. You burn whatever it is to a crisp. And then see how much the temperature of the water raises by. And it says, okay, this candy bar has 250 calories. Pretty much, that's what it does. The problem, obviously, is that, or maybe not obviously, because otherwise people would change this, is we're not a bomb calorimeter, okay? We cannot extract every single calorie from every item of food. And so I think we need to consider what I term caloric availability, which is the amount of calories you can extract from a food versus the amount of calories stuck in a food.
Even the same food is different in different forms. You mentioned a raw piece of chicken has less calories than a cooked piece the other way around.
No. So a raw piece of chicken will have exactly the same number of total calories in it, whether or not it's cooked or raw, when you put it in a bomb calorimeter.
Right.
But what our body can absorb from it, okay? Yep. Because what cooking, with the invention of fire and what have you, cooking became an external stomach. So some of the work is actually done for you outside, you know, before you actually eat it. So I forgot what the exact numbers are. But by cooking the chicken, okay, compared to eating it raw, you shouldn't eat raw chicken, you end up actually getting about, I think the number 20% more calories just by cooking it. I'll give you a more understandable scenario. Celery, okay?
Yep.
Where people think that celery famously has negative calories, doesn't have negative calories. But, meaning that it takes more calories to digest than in there. It doesn't. But a single medium stick of celery probably has only 6 calories, so it's almost negative.
Mm.
But if you cook it, if you put it in a stew or gumbo, what have you, that exact same stick of calories suddenly reveals 30 calories that you're able to absorb. And that's because of the cooking process. So when you're saying, I'm going to have 100 calories of something, you've got to know where the calories have actually come from.
Yeah, you don't think calorie counting is a good idea, do you, really?
I don't think calorie... I think calorie information on food at point of purchase, it works. So once again, colleagues of mine in Cambridge have shown that if it's there, a muffin has 400 calories, it will reduce your chances of buying that muffin by about 8 to 10%, and therefore presumably how much you eat. So that's fine, okay? It's a piece of information that's there. But say you're on some kind of intermittent fasting diet, and on your fasting day, you're supposed to have 600 calories, or 800, whatever the new number is. Then it matters whether you're having 800 calories of sugar or 800 calories of celery, because 800 calories of celery is like, what, 200 calories of celery, maybe? Whereas 800 calories of sugar is 800 calories of sugar. And so it does matter. So calorie counting per se makes no sense whatsoever if you don't take into account how many calories you can absorb. And just to ram the point home, every single calorie number you get, go to any supermarket and look at the back, okay? That number is bomb calorimeter number, which means that it doesn't inform you how many of those calories are absorbable to you.
But as well as the calorie, we also need the other stuff in the food as well, don't we?
Absolutely.
So you say the sugar versus celery versus red meat, all of them carry
all of them are very different from a nutrient perspective, clearly, because we need the three major macronutrients, meaning carb, fat, and protein at the right amounts. We need some fiber to keep our gut happy. And we need, obviously, micronutrients, which are vitamins and iron and iodine and things like that.
Why do we need fiber to keep our gut happy? What does that do?
Oh, so what the fiber does is to actually keep the gut bacteria, the microbiome, the stuff that Tim Spector talks about, and to keep everything happy and to keep you regular, okay? Because if you don't actually have the fiber, it's a couple of interesting things. If you don't have the fiber, you end up absorbing a lot more calories because fiber slows down the absorption of calories. Okay, which is, but you do need fiber in order to make sure that everything comes out the other side, you know, in a nice poopy form rather than in having to run in stepper form.
Right. You mentioned macros there. That when you're a bodybuilder or you're doing all that sort of stuff, people don't stop talking about it. Anyone in a gym. I've never bothered looking into it. What actually is it? What does it mean when people discuss calculating your macros?
Okay, I think what they're trying to say is how much, in a given meal, how much protein versus how much carbs they're eating and probably how much fat. And I think a bodybuilder or someone who's trying to be cut, okay, it's going to want less fat to lean up, okay? They probably think carbs are poison. And so pretty much they eat a lot of protein. So they're just, when they say counting their macros, they're literally not saying this is a chicken burger or this is something else. They're literally looking at a meal as a percentage of carbs, fat, and protein.
I love the way you said that about carbs, because let's get into some of these diets then, because what's interesting is there's a lot of confirmation bias out there, I think, and there's a lot of people who like their diets. And when you've worked on your TV shows and you've discussed the myriad different diets and everything else, you're hated when you go, where's the science? Or if you don't believe in what they're saying.
That's right.
It's like a religion for a lot of people, isn't it?
It is. It's evangelical, where... And our brain models things, humans, because it has kept us alive, right? Red berry, delicious. Blueberry, poisonous, or something. And it's kept you alive, so you model it. The problem is, if you therefore have a diet, and whatever the diet might be, and it suddenly works for you, suddenly you lose weight... Immediately you think, well, it worked for me. It worked for me. So why can't it work for everybody else? I think this is part of the issue. Well, it worked for me. Why can't it work for you? And then for many people, their diet becomes their personality. If you go on Twitter, this is the thing which I never understand, or Instagram, okay? Yeah. And you look at Charles Yeo and then hashtag keto or hashtag vegan. Why are you putting, you know, what your dietary preference is by who you are? This I never understood. Why is that part of who you are? Rather than geneticist or a father, just fine, okay, whatever it is. Why put what you're eating on there? That's never understand.
It's identifying people now, isn't it? I'm a meat eater, or I'm a carnivore. Yep.
Right.
Or I'm a vegan or something. And it's fascinating.
It is fascinating how it's become this, it's part of your character. And I think what happens is, because it's part of their character, it's not part of mine, but if it's part of their character, if you begin to challenge, Charles, why are you bald? Oh, I'm going to get offended. I'm not offended because I am bald. But if they challenge, part of the problem is if someone begins challenging your being, and if your being is important, if what you're eating is important to your being, I think you push back.
And I think one of the big things with hunger and eating is it happens to you 3 or 4 times a day, you'll get hungry.
Yep.
And it's one of the few things in life, because it's so important to us. And thirsty is another one, but people don't bang on about drinking water, do they? I suppose they do, actually. There's the, you know, you got to bring how many liters a day you have to, even if you're not thirsty,
to
keep slamming water inside you.
Just as an aside, I think if you respond to yourself and drinking when you're thirsty, I think you're going to be fine, except for maybe if you're running a marathon or something like that.
Right.
But typically, anyway, that's water.
That's water. So I suppose it's because it happens so often, it's become such a big part of our lives. I remember working in an office, the first time I became really conscious of food in a big way was I worked in an office, and I realized that half the people got to about 10 o'clock and they started talking about what they have for lunch, what they were going to have for lunch. And then as soon as we finished lunch, they were discussing what they were going to have for dinner.
That's me, by the way.
Is it?
Yes.
Right. So this constant talk about what we're going to eat constantly. So I suppose then you find a diet and you find a bit of control in your life.
That's right.
Because I'm a vegan, I'm a carnivore, I'm paleo, whatever it is. You're like, I now can control it because we cannot control this urge. You know, we all get sexual urges. We can, majority of us can sort of control them. The hunger one, we just have no ability to control at all, do we?
Because at the end of the day, we will be exposed to the food.
Yeah.
So, because you have to, otherwise you're dead. And so therefore, if you have, for whatever reason, the require to try and control something, then that is something you can control because you're going to be exposed to the food, like you say, three times a day or twice a day, however many times
yeah.
you eat.
And we all know the stuff we really want to do is we just want to stuff our face full of bread and cakes and chocolate and beer and, you know, and crisps. And that's what we love. I mean, we do all love all the lovely tasting food, but we're craving that sort of stuff, aren't we, really?
Some people do. Not everyone does. Not everyone does. I mean, I think it's one of the things where you can ask. Okay, I think
really not everybody does.
No, I don't think so.
I just disagree with that.
I think what will be a revealing question to ask anybody, and I'll ask you actually, is do you love food? Okay. Now let's just think about that with all of the baggage that comes with that. All right.
Yeah.
I love food. I'm the person who I already know what I'm going to have for dinner tomorrow night because I'm going to cook it and I already know exactly what I'm going to have for dinner tomorrow night. Exactly. Okay.
Mm.
Down to everything is already in there because I talk about them. My wife is always going, why are you always talking about food? I said, I'm not. I'm just planning it so that when I'm hungry, I'm not stressed about where I'm going to get my food. I've got friends, however, who treat food as fuel. So they will get hungry. Everyone gets hungry by its very definition, but they don't think about food till when they're hungry. Then they go, ooh, I'm hungry. And so they end up eating cheese sandwiches every day for lunch because that's what's available at the shop and you go. So I don't think that people crave it all the time. When you're hungry, that's a very different thing. So people crave different things for different reasons.
Mm. Tim Spector put me on a clinical trial. I did this clinical trial with Mark did it as well. There's the biggest clinical trial, I think, of this description. And as part of it, we had to have food for the first few days. All the food was given to us. And then as time went on, it was just breakfast. And I loved it so much that somebody else was deciding what I was going to eat. Because it had enough food, it had all the right things in there for me to survive for a day, but they wanted to it was different values in it. Some were more, had more carbs in them, some more sugar.
And you're just eating what they gave you and you said, oh, I'm having a trial. And
exactly. And it's just the best thing ever for me because it was just like, someone's telling me what to eat. And I must be very similar to being a vegan or being on the paleo or something. Someone's telling me what I can do. And so I'm sticking to those laws and those rules, whereas I eat everything and can eat everything and do eat everything. So so I don't have those rules and laws, I suppose.
For some people, that is a workable solution. I mean, if you look at the Hollywood superstars,
okay,
who can afford to just have someone, you need to have your six pack and look good.
Yeah.
Then you just hire someone and say, look, you just make sure that I'm eating the right thing whenever you want. And I then don't worry about it.
I think that's the future.
For some people, I think for other people like me, I would hate it. I would hate it with a passion.
No, you wouldn't because you wouldn't be hungry because your leptin.
No.
I'll be keeping your leptin.
This has two things. There's two things. There's the hunger issue. This is the grumbly. Yeah. This is the grumbly feeling.
Yeah.
But then there's the rewarding element. So there's two parts of your brain, right? So you need go back to evolution. And let's go back to the bear and the salmon.
Yeah.
Where in effect you need to eat more than you need because you don't know when you're gonna get your next meal.
Yeah.
But the hunger will stop when you have achieved your caloric. In other words, if you have burnt 2,000 calories, the moment you get to 2,000, you will stop feeling hungry. But how do you then make sure you eat more than you need? The bit that makes food taste nice, that makes it feel good, okay, that takes over.
Yeah, but if I've stopped your hormones going, get some food in me, then you won't care about the reward, will
Depends
you?
Where the hormone signals. So some hormones signal to the hunger bit. Some hormones actually eventually trickle into the rewarding element. So imagine a scenario where good food feels good. Not only does it taste nice, it also feels good. Ooh, okay, when you actually get. But imagine if you need to eat more food to get the same ooh.
Yeah.
Now, if you need to eat more food to get the same ooh, then it's not about hunger anymore, but it's about tickling your reward element.
So I'll provide you with three drinks a day. Yeah. Those companies doing that, right?
There are.
But then I'm going to give you a little couple of sweets a day, which gives you the ooh, and yeah. then I sorted your problem out.
I don't know. I think I love food too much.
Okay.
How do you solve the issue where I already know what I'm going to have? I probably know what I'm going to have for Sunday for dinner. Okay. Just because I, even though I haven't been to the supermarket.
What are you
going to
have today? What are you going to have tonight?
Tonight.
Yeah.
Tonight, I'm having a chicken, chickpea, and chorizo stew with focaccia.
You're allowed to eat chorizo. It's processed food.
Ah, so that's the... stop for a sec. Do we have enough time? What is processed food?
Well, I don't know. I've got time. Have you got time?
What is processed food? I have time.
Good, let's do it.
Tell me what's processed food.
Processed food is stuff what man have played around with.
So it's cooking. Cooking is a process.
Mm-hmm.
So it's processed... I think it's all in the detail. So if you cook something, okay, that is a process. Is it bad? No. If you pasteurize your milk, is it bad? That is not a process. I think... I know what you're asking.
All right, let's do the... Can you remember the stats of the difference between processed food, which I've cut out of my diet because I've been worried about the warning signals of sausages and bacon and things like that and ham. And yet you put the stats in the book in comparison to smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, get it in perspective here.
Okay, so a couple of things. When it comes to something like cancer... Smoking is a huge risk factor. So huge, it's measured in double digits. It's the deadliest legal thing that we can actually do. Now, obviously, there are also foods that we eat which can increase your risk of cancer, just not that much compared to something like smoking. Doesn't mean that you should go out and eat as much bacon or processed, meaning preserved meats like that. No, I mean, this is not what I'm saying at all. But what I'm saying is that I think you need to take these messages, put it in some form of perspective, and I think we need to eat less of bacon and sausages, undoubtedly. Red meat is probably next down on the list, although that's equivocal, and white meat and fish, I don't know if they're actually dangerous for you if you eat them in moderation.
Well, tell us about red meat then, whilst we're there, because everyone says red meat is really bad for you. Yeah, it must be as a pure calorie, it must be one of the best you can actually get your hands on. It's absolutely rich in goodness.
It is rich. It is rich in goodness.
So why are people saying that is the one that's bad for you?
I think eating too much of it is bad for you rather than eating it. There is going to be a safe dose of red meat.
Why?
Why is there a safe dose of red meat?
Yeah, why? Because there are people and animals as the carnivores. Let's go on to the carnivores.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Who will say that and the paleos, a lot of them like it, don't they? It's the perfect food you can eat. Who has decided that it's bad for you in high doses?
Okay, so in high doses, it increases your risk of something like bowel cancer. So that's the first thing. Now, here's the interesting thing.
100% certain about that?
Ah, okay. So here's the caveat. From population studies, does red meat, processed meat, I think, is unequivocal that it slightly increases your risk of cancer. And so as a result, we do have to take it seriously in many studies. Red meat is slightly less equivocal. Okay, definitely. Slightly less unequivocal, I'm sorry, for sure, where there are some studies which don't see it, but there are more studies than not which shows that it increases. If you eat too much of it, it does increase your chance of something like bowel cancer. But here's the interesting thing about risk. For some people, that risk is 100% when they eat it. For other people, it's zero. So it depends on who you are.
And also, you're missing out on, what's the thing that everyone gets from red meat? B12 or something? What's the
B12 from animal-based products. So B12 right. For sure. Yep, yep. So
if you start cutting out meat, then you might become...
Then you do have to worry about making sure you have a complete spectrum of protein... But you can get that from plant-based protein, and make sure that you have a complete spectrum of micronutrients. So in particular, B12 and iodine.
Okay, so we talked about paleo, and one of the big things with paleo diet is that anti-carbs. There's a big anti-carb movement, isn't there, which is going on. And I must admit, I've sort of fallen trapped to that a bit. And the reason being is that when I had my back operation, I decided to, I couldn't exercise as much. So I thought, well, what can I do? So I looked around and it seemed to make sense to me. So I cut out a lot of carbs, but bread mainly. And then I cut out some pasta, I cut out some rice, I cut out... Blah, 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 blah. And then in your book, you say, if you cut out too much carbs, it can have detrimental effects. And one of them being that leg cramps. Oh my God, the leg cramps I've suffered. And now I realize where it's come from. It's because I don't have any carbs in my diet sometimes. I go through days if not eating.
So I think the carb is poison has come from a number of different things. I mean, undoubtedly... particularly refined carbohydrates do release sugar very, very yeah. quickly because that's what they're designed to do. Okay. So that can be a problem for some people. The calories are very available. Okay. Because from sugar. But the way these low carb diets work is not because of the low carb, but because you've increased the protein, right? Because you got to make up the calories of something else.
Yeah.
And fat in of itself is actually quite unpalatable by itself. Mixed with carbs, like in pasta or like in pastry, is delicious. But by itself, who eats butter? By itself, no one does. So you replace it with protein. And what protein does is protein is chemically more complex than fat or carbohydrates, so it takes longer to digest. Because it takes longer to digest, it travels further down the gut, it makes you feel fuller. You feel fuller, you eat less. So how all of these, anything from carnivore to paleo to Atkins, and they're probably in that order of severity of the amount of carb restriction and therefore amount of protein you eat, that will always make you feel fuller. Okay, because a calorie of protein makes you feel fuller than a calorie of fat and a calorie of carbs. Once again, in that order, you eat less, you lose weight. That's how these high protein, low carb diets work.
Isn't that our caveman brain then, or our brain from years ago going, this is the stuff we need? Brilliant, thank you, thumbs up, Tim, well done. You've eaten some.
For certain cavemen or for certain people of the time, so for example, probably the Inuit, the Eskimos, who, where the hell were they going to grow cucumbers from, right? In the snow, no one. So they ate seal blubber and they ate seal. Mm. Okay, and that's probably true for them. But if you were in a rainforest, okay, or if you were on an area that was rich in vegetables and you had to chase down the antelope for 5 days to actually get any meat, you'd actually be largely vegetarian. Okay, so I think the paleo argument, the caveman argument, is from the Flintstones. I think it depends who you are. It depends where you lived. There were a lot of paleo people who were largely vegetarian because they had to run for 5 days to track down the antelope. So you ate beans and ate roots.
I'm doing my own confirmation bias here, though. But I went for Jake Shields came on my show. He's an MMA fighter for the UFC and everything. He's vegetarian since birth and he's in great shape. And I thought, do you know what? Maybe I ate too much meat. So I started going vegetarian. I did it. I just did an experiment like you're doing. Mm-hmm. I like to experiment on myself. And I did a few weeks of it and I was so hungry. I couldn't stop eating. I put on two kilos. I was just eating. I was eating chickpeas and beans and stuff like that, but I didn't stop eating. Is that because my body's used to having the protein, which fills me up?
I think probably it's going to depend on your individual biology. So for me, for example, I went on a plant-based diet. I ended up losing weight. Okay, I ended up losing weight because I found myself getting full more easily on beans. But that's not because, you know, that being vegan is therefore the perfect diet. For me, it happened to suit me. Whereas clearly, you like your intermittent fasting. I hated it, right? Whereas you like it and you're able to do that. You got to find, and I guess it's the key message, where there are most diets out there actually do work for some people, certainly in the short term. You just have to find the one that suits you.
And I suppose we've got to point out at this stage that we're all very different.
Yes.
As people and humans, and actually as races, we're different.
As races, we're different.
Which is a hard thing to say on a podcast.
No, but it's...
get accused of racism.
No, but I'm not being... But it's true. Okay, in terms of the actual general biology, it's going to be roughly speaking the same. How we handle glucose, how we handle, you know, this and that. The fact that gut hormones make you feel full and the fact that we have leptin. We're going to be human because of that. But nutrient partitioning. So what we actually do with nutrients... whether or not we actually store or burn a specific calorie when we eat it, that is going to differ depending on your genes. And if you talk about genes, you have to talk about our ethnicity and our safe fat storing capacity. So how much fat we can store safely before we actually get into disease, that is also going to be very, very dependent on our genes and therefore our ethnicity.
Yeah, so because you're Chinese, mm-hmm. You don't get more fat cells. You only have your ones you're actually born with, don't you? And if
you probably do, I get a little bit more, a little bit less, but broadly speaking, fat cells are like balloons.
Right.
When you gain weight, they get bigger. When you lose weight, they get smaller. But you don't gain or lose fat cells during that process.
And so when it's dangerous, is the fat cells are full up, and then it ends up, the fat ends up going into your muscles.
And liver.
And liver.
And that is then, because they're not designed to store a huge amount of fat, it interferes with their function, and therefore it makes you get ill.
So if you're Chinese, your cells fill up quicker. And if you're Polynesian, they fill up slower.
Pretty much. Oh, no. Not quicker or slower.
Sorry, you get more in.
Bigger. Exactly. So in other words, the balloons get... So once again, this is not universal. And clearly, there are going to be some very, very large Chinese people. But if we take the population average, undoubtedly, Chinese people cannot get, beyond a BMI of... in fact, some people say, for example, that for Chinese people, we should consider overweight at 23, for example.
Right.
Okay, rather than 25, because of this, right. this.
And you also being Chinese, your intolerance to dairy.
Mm.
Yeah, you didn't know that.
I didn't know that. I know why I didn't know that. I'm not sure. I thought everything was normal until I went for one of these genetic tests, which told me I was, and I didn't quite believe it. Then I knew my dad could never drink milk all the time, whereas my mum could eat yogurt and she has some cheese. And so I thought I was fine. But no, as it turns out, I am lactose intolerant. My favorite drink in the morning used to be a cappuccino. Suddenly I removed it. And things were different on the loo. I was going, ooh, this is a novel experience. And there we go. I'm lactose intolerant.
But didn't you say to your mum, I'm lactose intolerant, are you? And didn't she sort of say, yeah, go on.
Yes. So I called my mum when I figured it out. And I said, are you lactose intolerant? She goes, of course I am. I said, what do you mean, of course you are? Why didn't you tell me? She goes, because I just assumed you knew. I said, God. So no, I didn't know. I know, and I study food, right? So this is it. This is the difficulty.
But why is it that some of us can tolerate dairy then, and some of the people in the world can't?
Okay, so most people in the world cannot drink milk, cannot tolerate dairy as adults. Most people in the world, okay? So what happens is actually all mammals clearly can drink milk when they're young. That defines us. That's what we are. But then what happens is that as they grow older, they stop being able to do this. We cannot absorb lactose, which is the sugar found in milk, by itself. It has to be chopped into two, okay, by something called lactase.
Yeah.
So what happens is as we grow older, all mammals, something binds kind of like in front of the lactase gene, shutting it off, okay, as adults. Why? Presumably to kind of get university-age Johnny off the boob, and so that baby Johnny can come along and actually have something to drink, okay? So probably because of that. But what happened with the dairying, with agriculture, is that you begin to get, cows and sheep and goats. And people begin to realize that, hang on a second, if we actually drank the milk before we ate the cow, we would get a hell of a lot more calories than if we just ate the cow. And people actually calculated this. In a Neolithic cow tended to produce around 600 to 700 liters of milk a year. Compare this to a Holstein Friesian, which makes 10,000 liters, but let's ignore that. That's probably 10 times the number of calories in the total cow. And so as a result, because of that selection pressure, okay, a single mutation occurred in probably someone in where is now Denmark, preventing the protein from binding to shut off lactase. So lactase is never turned off. 95% of Northern Europeans, most of the British included, can drink milk as adults. All of you have exactly that same mutation, stopping the binding of the protein, turning off lactase. So you can drink milk as adults. I can't drink milk as adults.
How much of the world can do it then? Just
2/3 of adults in the world cannot drink milk as adults.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you get this message through, and then everybody in Britain goes, I can't drink it, I'm lactose intolerant. And because that's the message.
But that's not the message. The message is, for Chinese people, I'm not going to go be eating that. But that is something you can test for, because it's one gene. And so you can actually test for that.
So is it bad for us to drink it? I drink milk. Is it bad for me?
If you drink too much milk, there's a waistline issue. There always is going to be there. Or eat too much cheese. But no, because lactose, you have to remember, lactose is a sugar, like glucose, like sucrose, like fructose. If you can digest lactose as an adult, it's safe to drink milk.
Okay. All right, just a couple more things, if you don't mind, before we get into the questions. First of all, vegan versus plant-based. You got yourself in trouble about that.
I did get myself. So vegan, I think we understand as not eating anything which has any animal bits in it, okay? Mm-hmm. So I think that's almost easier to understand. Plant-based is more complex because plant-based then takes into account the processed nature of the food. So crisps and any number of other things. A soda, diet soda, for example, or even a full-fat soda, refined sugar, would not be considered plant-based. So plant-based means that you're eating food which sort of resembles the plant which it comes from.
So what do you think of plant-based or veganism, either one of them? Or I suppose I shouldn't put them together, should I really? But what do you think of plant-based?
Well, let's put it together for now. I mean, I think it's one of these situations. I draw a big distinction between being vegetarian, which means you eat eggs and milk, and being vegan. Because I think for much of history, we were probably almost vegetarian, if only because meat was so expensive to actually chase down, or to why would you eat the cow if you could drink the milk? Whereas veganism, I think, is a healthy way to live if you do it properly, if you watch out for the deficiencies that are actually there, which naturally are found in probably milk and eggs. Let's just go with that for now. Whereas it's difficult to be vegan because of the micronutrient deficiencies and the fact that you've got to watch everything so carefully. So I think veganism is a choice, whereas I think you can, and it's a privileged choice, whereas I think you can be vegetarian cheaply. And actually live very, very healthily. So vegan is healthy as long as you do it properly, but you have to understand that it's a choice.
The protein you're getting from vegetarianism, say, through beans, chickpeas, things like that, does it have the same effect as animal protein as it travels through your body?
It does, except but protein in vegetables and in plant-based protein is less dense. So you can get a lot of protein into a steak. You got to eat a lot of lentils or chickpeas to match a steak. But the protein, once you extract it, does exactly the same thing, whether or not it came from a cow or it came from a chickpea.
Okay, so I suppose the thing we didn't talk about, we just touched on it, is the hatred for carbs. And it's sort of also connected to gluten because everyone thinks it's the same thing.
That's right. Well, gluten is a protein. Gluten is a protein in not all carbs. So for example, rice doesn't have any gluten in it, but it gives bread and pasta its elasticity, okay? And so it just happens to be part of that specific grass grain, okay, that are there. The problem is, obviously, some people are allergic to gluten, people who are celiac, and there's gluten intolerance, and that causes some kind of autoimmune problem, and it's bad, and you want to stay away from gluten. Somehow, it's been conflated together with the anti-carb movement, and so people now consider, you know, gluten-free and carb almost like the same thing, which is a silly thing.
But were we eating, or are we eating, too many carbs? I mean, I know you're telling us we need carbs, but do you think we have been eating too many carbs?
Are we getting more of our calories from carbohydrates now compared to pre-agriculture? Probably. Okay. Once again, it depends who you are. Okay, and where, but probably. So what agriculture did was two things. It reduced the variety of foods that we get. This is undoubtedly true, which is probably not a great thing. But secondly, it also introduced entirely new foods. So those two things. And it increased the availability of certain foods, particularly grain-derived carbohydrates. So we are eating more carbohydrates than we are today, probably on average.
Which probably makes us fatter.
Because of two different reasons. Not because carbs are poisonous, but because carbs are more calorically available.
Okay. Right.
So if you eat 100 calories of carbs, sugar, probably 98 calories for every 100 calories you eat. Starch in bread, probably 95 calories for every 100 calories you eat, okay? Fat is nearly 100% available, 98, 99 calories per 100 calories. Protein, you only ever absorb, on average, 70 calories out of every 100 calories of protein you eat because it takes so long to digest. By the time you extract all the calories, there's the energy involved, and you poop the rest out. That pretty much is it. So I think just by actually, so this is why people think carbs are bad. It's because they are fully available. So if you have 100 calories of carbs, you're always going to get more calories out than 100 calories of protein. So since people think carbs are bad, they're not. You just need to eat less of it.
So I won't go through your truths at the end, all of them, but what would you say then is the best way for people to go through life eating?
I think, okay, if you need to lose weight, there's some people who are probably fine and just do what you got to do. Okay, but if you need to lose weight because your doctor tells you or because you feel you need to lose some weight, then you got to find, you have to stick on a diet. Otherwise, the weight will come back on. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you have to find something that suits you and that you can sustain for the rest of your life.
It's a lifestyle change. Yeah. And there's no secret. It's less calories in if you want to lose weight. So a few less calories in to the amount you need. And
that's right. But it's the strategy of how you reduce your calories. Right. That's going to differ between you and me.
And exercise?
Exercise, if you don't tackle the food intake element, exercise in of itself is not effective in weight loss unless you're Mo Farah. But yeah. So mere mortals don't exercise enough. So you have to tackle the food intake. That being said, two things. I don't want to be an anti-exercise person. Two things. Exercise is quite effective at helping you maintain weight loss. So in other words, as an energy to you keep the weight off. And independent of whether or not you put the weight on or keep the weight off, exercise, nothing replicates the health benefits of exercise. So exercise is good for you independent of whether or not you gain or lose weight.
All right. And I suppose another message is understand you're supposed to be hungry. Understand that your body is desperate for you to put fat on because it's a survival
technique. That's why it's difficult. It's not because you're bad.
Don't beat yourself up about it. That's everyone's right. Finding this difficult. That's and right. Everyone's struggling. But I imagine there's different levels of hunger. Like my hunger may be, say, at 20%, someone else's might be at 80%.
That's correct.
So don't beat yourself up. Just work out what's going on in your
and
head.
And don't and therefore, for someone who's skinny, don't judge how someone else is feeling and why this person is lazy.
Okay.
You don't know how hungry they're feeling based on the scenario. You only know you. Don't judge someone else.
Yeah. Is there and I suppose if you're going to lose weight as well, because it's such a hard thing to do, try and do it over a long period of time. Is that correct? So set yourself a 5-year goal rather than a 5-month goal.
So clearly it depends on who you are. But if we understand that if you do something extreme, you won't be able to stick to it. If I went on a 7-day water fast, of course I'm going to lose weight, but then everything is going to come back on.
Yes.
Whereas if I try to aim to lose a kilo, I don't know, every 6 months or something, or whatever rate is, you're more likely to be able to keep it off.
Yeah. And finally, in the future, what do you think is going to happen as you're studying all these things? What do you think is going to happen?
I mean,
how are you going to change it?
I do have colleagues who are working on a way of kind of weaponizing gut hormones in order to try and pretend that you've eaten, so it make you feel fuller without actually eating. But I think for the vast majority of us, the answer is going to be, and you know, I'm not countenancing drugging the entire population. I think for the rest of us, we need to be able to personalize our diets for those of us who need to lose weight. And that probably at some point is going to involve a genetic test in order to try and predict what we can or cannot eat. We're not there yet. But at some point in the future, we probably will get somewhere close.
Because we're all different. Let me ask you the questions I ask everybody. Have you got enough time to quickly do this? You sure? Okay. Yes. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
If you make yourself more of a pain in the backside to replace than to keep, when push comes to shove, you'll always have a job.
Okay, I like that one. That's good. What's it like being famous? Now, I'd like to steer this one slightly in the famous in the world of food, because we just touched on it a minute ago about, you know, you seem to be everybody's enemy.
So people think I judge them, and so therefore people think I am... People think many things of me. That I'm in the pocket of big food, I'm not. That I'm in the pocket of pharma, I'm not. I can't be both. And that I'm in the pocket of anything, that I'm trying to invent a pill, I'm not. All I'm trying to do is understand biology. People think that when I study the genetics of something, I'm giving someone an excuse. I'm not. I'm just trying to understand how something works.
Does it hurt you when people say you're being paid off?
Oh, initially it did. Now it doesn't bother anymore because it's just entirely false. And because once I knew it was entirely false, and I realized, well, then people just banging on. Whereas initially, when I first got the initial rush of hate, it did perturb me because it does perturb you. And it's water off a duck's back now.
What's the biggest mistake you've made?
I mean, I think that's... I don't think I've made any grievous mistakes. I think I've made, you know, all kinds of... a whole series of stupid mistakes, but that... largely involved with being a teenager and male. So I think I've made many small mistakes. Nothing overly grievous to date that has that has altered my my life.
How's your alcohol intolerance, by the way? Because you talk about the fact that a lot of people in Asia, or is it China, or is it both? Both Asia and China.
Asia, but, China, a lot of the indigenous populations as well. Can't tolerate alcohol on average. I think there are probably... I'm probably in the middle. So my mum can enjoy a glass of wine. I can enjoy a glass of wine. My dad can't even breathe the bubbles from champagne. He'll get pink. So I think I sit in between, but I can't drink as much as my white friends. So it's somewhere in the middle. Although I practice and try.
Can the intolerance get better over time?
I think that probably has an issue of, can you turn on the enzymes? I don't have any evidence for this, but I think I'm a little bit better than I was before because I exercise. Yeah, my alcohol drinking.
Any life hacks?
Yeah, actually, there are two rice-based, not that I want to back myself into a stereotype, but I have two rice-based hacks. So the first one is, how do you know how much water to add into rice? This is long grain rice. And my mum always taught me the knuckle technique. So you fill a pot pan of water, you put rice in there. Yeah. And then what happens is you take your middle finger, fill the water to your first knuckle, and that, generally speaking, is enough water to cook rice.
Perfect.
The second one is, what happens if you have underripe fruit, avocados, mangoes, in which you want to eat. Actually, if you take a big bag of rice, which I always have, I know it depends on how much rice you have. If you actually put it into the rice, it helps it ripen quicker. Not because of anything magic, but because it actually... So fruit ripen as they send out signals to each other, like bananas all go yellow at the same time. And so if you actually... It encloses the signals, bring the signals closer to the fruit, and it makes the fruit ripen a little bit quicker.
Ah, good knowledge. I like that. Mm-hmm. Can you recommend a book?
Yes. Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. And he's a Nobel Prize winning economist. And the Thinking Fast and Slow comes from the fact that our brain models something. Okay, so your brain immediately makes a snap judgment about something, which very often is wrong. Okay, and then if you think slowly and begin to actually pull something apart... Okay, then you begin to start to think about things.
But don't they have all those programs where they get these specialists in to look at art or something and they decide whether it's a fake or not? And the experts, their initial reaction is usually the correct one. Haven't they got all that?
No, but that's very different. But that's because you actually are given information that you're there and you are actually an expert. Whereas if you actually I'm gonna give you an example. Okay? This is straight from the book. Let me think about this. I'm going to get this wrong now. You're putting me under pressure.
No, you put yourself under pressure. I didn't ask you to to tell me this.
Oh my God! I forgot the example. I'm going to have to stop.
What is it? What is the example?
The example is okay. I want you to answer this question. What is the name of?
Do you want me to find it in the book?
No, it's not in the book. It's in Daniel Kahneman's. Thinking Fast and Slow. I think there are things in which you oh my God, I can't imagine it. I can't do it. I'm sorry. This is terrible. You put me under pressure.
Give us what it was going to be then, the rough outline of it, and then I can...
Okay, and then you can do it. So, yeah. Okay, so how many animals, how many animals were actually... Oh, my God.
I'm so desperate to know what the end of this is.
How many...
Is it to do with Noah?
How many... So you spoiled it now. Yes, it was. So the point is, how many animals did I think I forgot the name of the other person. So how many animals of each animal were brought onto the ark by, and I was going to say something like Isaiah, okay?
Right.
But then what happens is people are thinking ark, people are thinking everything, and immediately you say two, whereas everyone ignored the fact that I used Isaiah instead of Noah. Because it's a biblical name. And I can't remember the name he used. This is why I didn't want to get Daniel Kahneman mad at me. But what happens was, his thing is that there are things in which we think of very, very quickly that makes us feel, this must be wrong. And it's about how our brain plays tricks on us. And he's an economist. And so this is how we actually think about economics. And we need to think not only fast, we need to be able to react, but also to slow down our thinking to try and get the right answer.
So if you'd said Isaiah or something, whatever you said there, I'd have possibly thought, well, he said it wrong, but I'm going to go to anyway because I don't want to embarrass him.
There's that as
so
well.
So there's that bit of it.
Yeah, no, I screwed it up. I should have done it better. I don't know why I said it and then suddenly realized I didn't know.
What's his name? Terrible. Daniel.
Daniel Kahneman.
I'll get him on instead.
He'll do it better.
What's the final question? What's the meaning of life?
Well, I'm sure everyone says 42. I think to my mind is the meaning of life is making the most of the... I sound like a fortune cookie. Making the most of the luck that is given to you. Because I think we underestimate how much luck has to do with our life. We do. And people try and pretend they're freaking geniuses. Yeah. Mostly are lucky. And I think... But the trick is to make sure... The meaning of life is to, when luck lands on you, to make the most of it.
Okay. Do you enjoy doing the TV stuff?
I do.
Will you be doing any more?
Yeah. Hopefully. I've just finished filming season 9, I think, of Trust Me, I'm a Doctor.
Okay. And anything else you want to talk about? Any other projects coming up? Apart from the book. You got to get this book, by the way. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was one of those ones that I was going to go in and just flick, and I didn't. I've read the whole thing because it was just
thank you.
The information. I just think you've done it properly. You've got all the information down, and confirmation bias is terrible when it comes to science and diet, and I don't think you've got any in that. Well, you can't. You're a scientist, but I think there's a lot of that around.
Oh no, I think we scientists have confirmation bias. Do
you?
We're all the time in terms of results and fighting it. It's being able to fight it. I think it's human nature for confirmation bias, because that's just how we're designed. It's to make sure you know about it, fight it. Don't deny when it happens. And when someone points it out to you, says, you're right, confirmation bias.
Yeah.
I think it affects everyone.
Perfect. All right. Well, where do we follow you? You're on Instagram.
I'm on Instagram and I'm on Twitter at Giles Yeo.
Spelled Y-E-O. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Thoroughly enjoyed your company.
Cheers,
Giles. Thank you. So that was Dr. Giles Yeo. His book is called Gene Eating, The Science of Obesity and the Truth About Diets. I could have talked to him for, I reckon, 2 or 3 hours, Mark.
He couldn't wait to get away from you. He was fascinating.
So interesting. What I find the most interesting thing about it is our urge to eat. And that's what I learned reading his book. And also, we didn't cover all the diets in here. We didn't talk about detoxing. Which he's got lots of stuff on that and juicing and all those sort of things. It's thoroughly worth a read. I mean, we eat every day. Do you eat every day?
Yes.
Yes. So it's worth knowing why we're eating and what we're sticking in our mouth. I do think that's a fascinating thing he was talking about though with his fasting, because I think I'd really struggle to fast 2 days a week. I mean, I'm fine with intermittent fasting, just going a few hours without eating, but a whole day without eating.
It's classed as under 600 calories, isn't it? Not eating.
Yes, I think so.
So you can have like a couple of cuppa soups or something. I don't know, something like that. Yeah.
Cuppa soups.
Whatever, I don't know.
Slice of nimble bread on the side.
I liked the actual description and explanation and process behind what he explained, what a calorie physically is, and I know what they are, but what it actually is, and how they measure them in food.
Yeah,
that's fascinating.
Well, if you read the book, there's loads of stuff on that. I mean, there's bits where he gets really scientific, where you've got to really strain your brain to work out what he's talking about, but he just cover it all. He really explains what the hell is going on when you're eating food, and he's also taken all the diets, most of them anyway, all the ones that I'm aware of, and he's gone and analyzed them and put the science behind them. So it's really good. It just does seem that it's a matter of not to have too many calories. If you're having more calories in to your body than you're actually using, you're going to start storing it as fat, and it just seems to be that. But they're absolutely fascinating insight into it all there. This podcast is sponsored by Quooker, pronounced Quooker. No, Quooker, spelt Quooker, pronounced Quooker.
It's good we've got that nailed down now. That
is the theme tune.
Turn on the cooker. Cooker spelled with a Q-U. Turn on the cooker and instantly make a brew. Turn on the cooker. Cooker spelled with a Q-U. Turn on the cooker. Hot water for vegetables too.
Yeah, 100 degree boiling hot water to your tap. You get your cold tap, your normal cold water. You get your hot water and you get your boiling hot 100 degree water and you get filtered cold water all from the same tap. I love it. My favorite thing in the kitchen. It's like I'm living in the future. That's what it feels like. We also do work with our friends at Beer 52. Mark, you're in charge of Beer 52
well,
now.
Yeah, no, my first question to you, Tim, I would say is, Tim.
Yes.
Would you like some free beer?
Do you know what? Yes, I would.
Okay, well, if you pay the postage and packing,
$5.95,
and you go to beer52.com/lovejoy, you can get a free case of beer today. I mean, you can order it today and it will come, you know, whenever it comes.
Okay, so it's Beer 52 as in B-E-E-R.
Beer 52 is the world's...
52 number. Yeah.
Yep, .com.
Okay.
/Lovejoy.
Why are they giving us free beer?
Well, they want you to try out their service. Beer 52 is the world's most popular monthly craft beer discovery club. Now, that's the word we're looking for, discovery. Okay. Go try lots of different beers.
Some of them I'll like and some of them...
Possibly, yes.
I mean,
if you don't, say if you don't like dark beers, you can tailor your box...
Mm-hmm.
You get 8 free beers, a snack, and the Ferment magazine, or Ferment magazine.
And where are they from this month?
They are Brexit beers.
Mm.
So it's all around. It's celebrating our European neighbours. And there's beers from everywhere, basically.
Are there beers from Northern Europe? Are there beers? Is Skull in there? Where's Skull from? Holland.
I don't know.
Is it Holland?
I don't know. They haven't specifically mentioned that on the.
It was advertised. It can't be. Can it be Holland? Because it was advertised by Vikings, wasn't it?
I mean, that might just be some
Obelix and what's his name? Asterix and Obelix. Didn't they?
Did
do
they?
It?
Was that them?
Yeah.
Or do you think it was Asterix alikes?
They did. No, because they did that thing, didn't they? It was actually them. Kids cartoon sponsoring beer. They did that thing, didn't they?
They're searching out the incredible and exclusive small batch craft beers from the world's greatest breweries and bringing them back for our members here.
Oh, okay, that's fantastic. Beautiful. They do, what else? So it's just European beers.
This month, yes.
What's another famous European beer that we love? Must be some Belgian beers in there. What else?
I expect so, yes.
Heineken.
That's not in there, Tim. That's a very nice beer, but these are smaller breweries craft beers. Yeah.
Beautiful. So what you do, you apply and you get you pay £5.95, you get a free crate, and then you could just cancel at any time.
Cancel at any time. There's no minimum commitment at all.
And
if you like the beers,
you stay on. You have more.
And if you like a certain beer, you can go to the website and order more.
Perfect.
Of that specific beer.
And we love it because the door sometimes knocks when we're doing this, and the beer arrives.
Fantastic!
It's really
and
exciting.
It's exciting. It's like Christmas every month.
I have that, and I also have my chocolate subscription one, which is really good.
But they're
dark
not
chocolate,
a,
but they're not sponsoring
us,
the show.
So
no.
Can, yeah,
not
on.
Yet. did you enjoy Dr. Giles Yeo? Will you be doing... is there anything in that made you think about your diet, Mark?
It made me fancy some chicken chorizo and chickpea stew.
Oh, I got really hungry when he started talking about it. I could eat that now. He does mention, actually, there's been a lot of discussion on when dinner is in the... I didn't talk to him about this. I should talk to him about this as well. So much. We've got to get him back. There's so much to talk about. But when do you have your dinner? What sort of meals do
very,
you have?
Very, very early.
Right. So are you having...
Two meals a day.
Right. Okay.
I have two meals a day. I have like a sort of... like a snacky... I fast between 6 and 10 o'clock in the morning. So 6 o'clock at night till 10 o'clock in the morning. So I might have a little snacky type thing at 10-ish just to stop feeling hungry. And then I'll have lunch at lunchtime. But then I have dinner before 6 o'clock.
So he mentions in the book that dinner, because, you know, there's a lot of discussion, is dinner lunchtime or is it evening? You know, you'd say dinner was evening, yeah? It's not lunch. Yeah, we have.
Well, don't, because we're getting to the whole supper, dinner, tea.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But he's got an explanation for it.
Has he?
Yeah.
Because you got in trouble, didn't you, on Twitter? Or did you get in trouble? We just got.
Oh, I get in trouble everywhere. What did I get in trouble about that? So, what would you do your dinners?
How lunch
would
you dinner.
Have
dinner?
So you have.
Well, we used to call it supper when we
were
kids.
Say you're having. Say you're a normal person, Mark, and not a freak, like I am, and like you are with our strange diets we do. On what would you have? Breakfast, lunch, dinner.
Yeah, or supper it's called.
You would have supper.
Well, we used to call it supper when we were growing up, but I call it dinner.
Right, okay. You'd call it supper. That's unusual.
Well, I think it might have been a sort of Polish thing.
Oh, because when we did that, that's interesting, because when we did it online, when we did it on Sunday brunch, sorry, the vast majority of people coming through going, a supper's just for posh people.
No, I don't think it is. I think it's a
foreign thing.
Yes. I was going to say cultural, but if you want to go foreign...
So he, Dr. Yeo says, dinner was the main meal of the day.
Right.
Now, historically, the best time to eat your dinner is lunch.
Right.
And actually, scientifically, I can't remember the facts and I can't be bothered to look it up now, but the best time to eat your dinner is in the middle of the day and not in the evening. Your body deals with it better. I thought this was myth, by the way, but he says there is a little bit of science. This is what happens, by the way, all through his book, which is great. Is he says there is some science, but there could be other reasons why it happens.
Yeah, and also it's almost like what are those things, gains in like not minimal,
marginal gains.
Marginal gains. So it's you're probably better off having your lunch at your dinner at lunchtime.
But it doesn't matter.
But it's you're not. It's
marginal gains. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
So when we're at school, because historically you'd feed your children at school times, that's why you have dinner ladies. Because it was the lunchtime thing, that's when they would have their main meal, and that's why we try. I think
it's just much easier, much more social to have it at night, isn't it? In the evening,
I personally, even though the science doesn't prove it, but eating a huge meal during the day,
it just knocks me.
Yeah,
sick,
I don't want to do anything. I just want to go home and go to bed. But that's maybe what we should be doing. We should probably be getting up. What I'd like to do, and one day I'm going to try. This might be my new experiment. I go to bed every night when it gets dark. And then wake up every morning as soon as it gets light. Just work out what it is, set my alarm, and then get up and just only be awake.
Well, just leave the curtains open, and then you wake up with a natural light.
I'll just keep sleeping through it. I can sleep through natural light.
I can't.
Oh, I can. That's because you're more animalistic than me. You're still part of nature. I've moved on. I've got a look. For God's sake, I've got a tap which gives 100-degree water. I'm not part of nature anymore. I'm living in the future. Right, that's it for this week's podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back very soon. For the time being, peace and love, Joy. Oh, by the way, if you want to text us or
we don't text him.
Can I give you a number?
Was it
07? If you want to tweet us at Tim Lovejoy, if you want to email us, dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. Please get your problems in. We'll be doing another mailbag soon, or anything else you want to discuss, do that. dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. Thank you very much. Peace and love, Joy.
Bye.